Welcome to the Life Talk Show, sharing ideas for meaning, joy, and success with Randy Kaye, Diana Hall, and Nikki Tombolides. Our mission is to initiate conversations that enrich and empower your life. And now, today's Life Talk Show. Well, good afternoon. I'm Randy Kaye with Nikki Tombolides, Diana Hall, and special guest today for this show called Addiction, It Could Be You, or Someone You Love. This is the Life Talk Show, and we want to thank our sponsors, Straight Up, Dynamic Printing, and Gabriel Tax and Accounting, who've been so amazing for us today. And Gabriel Tax and Accounting are located at 1297 Park Avenue in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Got about 7 weeks till those taxes are due, and that time flies. So let them help you. You can go to GabrielTax.com and find out all the information, and you'll hear more about them as the show progresses. But they're a proud sponsor of the Life Talk Show, and we really appreciate it. Also, Dynamic Printing, LLC, and they are found online at dynamicprinter.com. They're in Monroe, Connecticut, and believe me, they will match all your printing needs. You can walk in, you can contact them online, and they are also fabulous. So thank you for sponsoring it.
Thank you.
So we will bring in our guests in just a moment, but, you know, this is we try to do conversations to enrich and empower your life. And we got to talking about addiction. And, you know, addiction can be sort of like my husband is addicted to going to the gym. And maybe I'm addicted to having
moral
a skinny cow ice cream every night. You know, but there's addiction. And then there's heavier addiction. And that's really what we're going to be addressing this evening. It's almost evening. Drug addiction, alcohol addiction, the science of addiction. We will be talking with Marie, who is the mother of a child who is getting out of rehab soon, and we'll bring Marie in a moment. Another guest we'll be bringing in is Dr. Carlton Erickson, who's the author of The Science of Addiction, From Neurobiology to Treatment. So we're having the experts online. We have another expert coming in who is a professor of psychiatry and neurobiology and pharmacology at Yale, and it's Dr. Marina Picciotto. So we have quite the show coming up. You know, addiction is a fun, sometimes people throw it around, oh, I'm addicted to brownies or I'm addicted to, and you know, we all have things that sometimes feel like they have a little bit of control over us. Like as I said, I've got to have my skinny cow ice cream at night.
But
it doesn't really interfere with my, I mean, I can say, don't have it. I'm not going to run out and buy it.
I can say that I was addicted to cigarettes because I used to be a smoker.
Okay.
And I quit about 16 years ago, but I was addicted. It was very, very difficult for me to quit. It took me over 10 years of tries and tries to quit.
Wow. So what finally did it, do you think?
Well, a friend of mine died, and she died in June 20th of 1996, and September 1st, 1996, I quit. And I never wanted to smoke again.
And, you know, it's interesting. I was reading a little bit before the show, and what I've read about addiction, I know we're going to get into all this, and I just want to, but that really for addiction, something like a friend or somebody dying doesn't always...
No, doesn't trigger it, but
no.
It happened
so
that she was close to my age. She was not my mother's age. She was not.
She died from smoking. Is that what you're saying?
No, she died from cancer, but she was very close to my age at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of like, I don't know, it triggered something, but what Diana said is so true. It does not change because other people, she was very close to me and she was a dear friend. And it just, I don't know. I didn't even say because of her I quit. But now I'm looking back.
That was your wake-up call for some reason. You know, it's funny because, as we said, it is definitely a, excuse me, a widespread. Nikki, you brought in almonds and I ate one and now it's stuck in my throat. It's definitely like many things, it's a widespread term. It's used lightly. It's used heavily. We can say, but I think the common denominator is we may feel like addiction takes over us.
Well,
and we don't have control.
Yeah, and I used to joke, and my husband used to joke with me and say that I was a shopaholic. So I was reading this article, and there was this gentleman, Buzz Bisinger, and he was the author of Friday Night Lights, and he claimed to be a true shopaholic. He still is addicted to Gucci, believe it or not. And he listed all of the things that he owned by Gucci, 84 leather jackets and 200 pairs
of gloves.
Yeah, I'll
say he was addicted.
And spent tens of thousands of dollars on Gucci wear, you know, a clothing, and you joke and say, well, that's an, you know, shopaholic, is that really an addiction? But I think addiction, when it affects your life or takes over your life in some way, shape, or form.
Well, they also have gambling addiction. Right. There's a lot of
Internet
addiction.
Yeah. They don't call Crackberry Crackberry for nothing, right?
Yeah, it's funny. And as we said, it's a very broad term. I think we can define it as something that is either a psychological, and today we'll probably focus even more fully on a physical addiction,
right,
that can totally, it can take over your life, and in the worst case scenario, it can ruin your life. And it's something we have to find a way to get out of. So that's what today's show is about. You know, I do have a child who was addicted to marijuana. He has said that to me, and he is not good, currently clean, and it didn't ruin his life, but it certainly delayed progress. It certainly delayed his growing up. There were other issues as well, but you know, it's, life is easier for him now. He goes to meetings, and he no longer uses that, and it could have been a lot worse, and it could be a lot worse. So addiction is, experts debate whether addiction is a disease or a true mental illness itself, or whether it is something that coexists always with a major mental illness. There's so much to the science of it there. I've learned through some of my research, sometimes people try cigarettes and they just try them, and then they give them up, and it doesn't become an addiction.
The same with alcohol. Like, you drink a glass of wine, you're not an alcoholic.
Right.
So I cannot have one cigarette because I'm going to be back.
Exactly. And more research is showing that it could be genetic, but I'm not a doctor. We have two doctors coming, so I'm going
to
stop with that.
Answer all
I'm just going to say, you know, we've all been exposed to some form of addiction, from food to cigarettes, maybe prescription drugs ourselves and in our own families. And, of course, we've just recently lost Philip Seymour Hoffman, who I didn't even know had an addiction problem. When a celebrity is addicted, it tends to be all over the news. But I know, as a family member of someone who was affected, that we always say mental illness affects the whole family. Well, addiction affects the whole family as well. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to welcome our first guest, who was kind enough to come on with us. We're only going to use your first name, Marie. Marie has a daughter with an addiction who's currently in a rehab facility. So welcome to our show.
Welcome, Marie. Welcome. Thank you for being with us.
So can you, Marie, we'll just refer to your daughter as your daughter,
mm-hmm.
and however you're comfortable doing. Can you tell us a little bit about your situation, what's currently going on, what have you been through? Give us some background on your daughter, and what is she addicted to, where is she?
My daughter is addicted to heroin, and she is currently in a rehab facility. She'll be getting out next week, and she, you know, then she'll go into a sober living community, and hopefully she'll be able to do it this time. She's been, this must be the fifth or sixth time that she's been in.
Fifth or sixth. And she's how old?
She's 22.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So it's been going on for about 2 years.
Mm.
About 2 years. And how I first discovered it was she quit her job, or she lost her job. I'm not really sure what it was.
Was she on her own at this time?
No, she was living at home.
Living at home, okay.
So we had no idea. I mean, absolutely no knowledge that she was using anything. And we, you know, didn't think we were naive. I mean,
right, sure.
You know, we
as
know
we
about
all
drugs.
Don't.
We talked to our kids about them.
You did all the right things.
I did. I was a stay-at-home mom for most of her life until maybe she was 13 or so. So then I worked locally. I was home 5 o'clock. So it wasn't like I was traveling.
Neglecting
what was going on.
There isn't always a
psychological
point at the mother kind of thing.
It's
just how, okay, so you had no idea.
We had no idea.
Were there mood swings? Was there anything?
Well,
other than adolescence, which is mood swings, but.
Yeah, that was, this point, she lost her job, and then she was up all night, and then she would sleep all day.
Hmm.
And it was sort of like living in an insane asylum for us, because it really is. It is.
He
like
says
insane.
This is typical teenage behavior.
And I kept saying to my husband, "There's something. This is not normal." And so one night at 3 a.m, something woke me up, and she wasn't home. And I said, "You know, I'm going to check her room." And I went in her room, and I stuck my hand in one of her pockets of her jackets, and I found a needle. And then I just went like, I went, well, maybe it's not hers, because who wants to believe
that it's hers? Right.
So I took the needle, and then I eventually confronted, I showed my husband, and he was saying, well, it might be someone else's, and blah, blah, blah.
Because
he was more, he was more in, I think, the denial side of it. And I was saying, look, all the signs are pointing towards her doing it, using. So we confronted her, and of course she did say it was a friend of hers.
Mm-hmm.
And she was hanging around with this guy who she told me was a heroin addict. But then why is she hanging around with him?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, we can always look back and go, why didn't I see it? But, you know, parents, we have a way of looking at our children, and we certainly don't expect addiction to be...
No.
It wasn't in your... You know, you had...
So you find it,
and is she your only child?
No, I have another child. So it's 3.5 years younger.
Okay, another girl, boy?
Yes, another girl.
All right, so now you're like, and there are stages. There's denial, there's shock, there's anger, there's all of those. You know, the stages of grief, there's like 9 of them when you're, I believe, when you, someone is an addict.
I think denial is on top of the list.
I think it's a reaction, human reaction, everything.
When she told us about the needle, then you say, well, I mean, you
want
to believe.
You believe, yeah.
You want to believe.
That's
so,
right.
So we, you know, then she admitted that she was addicted to opiates, but like Percocet and not... necessarily the heroin. That was not her needle. So
not her needle.
I don't know why I thought that was better, but it's not. It's the same, really. Opiates are opiates.
And it seems less invasive, though, doesn't it?
Well, the needle part of it is when I did find out that it was actually heroin, it was as if it was like she died. It was like that morning that I
felt. That was heavy.
Was so deep inside that I just thought, oh, this can't be any... How much worse could it get? I mean, this is just terrible. So... I think I really did go through this period of mourning that I almost feel as if, that I almost feel as if, you know, anytime somebody calls me about it, I mean, I already went through all that. I might be able to go through, I might have to go through it again, but I really do feel that I did go through that terrible period when I found out.
Yeah.
It's just such a shock.
And I think the mourning is... You're mourning because it doesn't feel like your child.
Well,
so
you
something
have expectations for your child, and these are things that I didn't expect. And you know, I thought she, was going to be successful, go to college, get a great job.
As we all do as parents for our children. That's our hope for our children.
Well, I just want to say that I have addiction in my family, and my father was, for the longest time, and even when he died, he was in denial. It was something, especially coming from a Greek parent that, you know, they're very strict, they raise their children so strict. He couldn't accept it. He couldn't accept it that one of my siblings had the problem, a serious problem. With addiction, he couldn't. He died without accepting it, without coming to terms with it.
There's a lot of things. I think, you know, you may not know this, but I do have a son with schizophrenia, and as he was developing his symptoms, he did, as many people do with gradual onset schizophrenia, he turned to marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he might have gone further. But he's terrified of needles, and I thank God for that every day. I mean, I honestly think it saved him.
So is my daughter.
Yeah.
When she was younger, we used to have to hold her down to get her injection.
Yeah.
The fact that it didn't start out with the needles. They start snorting the heroin, and then someone says, hey, why don't you try it this way? It's better. And she didn't like needles, but she... I don't know. They just they change because...
And we'll ask the doctor about that when he comes up, but it's my understanding from talking to people who are in the process of recovering from addiction that there is no high like that first high, and you keep searching for that first high again. And so if you got that high when you're snorting and then you can't get that high again, then you try it with the needle, and the high becomes the addiction.
Then you go to a step up.
Right.
Right. So you are, as a mom, facing layers of obviously worrying about your child. And also, she's only 22.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you, as the mom of someone that I feared he would never have any success, that he's 31 now and some of his dreams are coming true. So it's not totally hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, but part of the thing is dealing with my kid's not perfect. My kid, I have to, this is not something you expect. And especially,
I'm sure there's communities like this all over the country, but Fairfield County, Connecticut is the world of perfect children, at least on the surface. And on top of grief and pain and worry for your child, we often feel like we're facing stigma and blame, and we blame ourselves. Why didn't we see it? Why didn't we do anything else? So, Marie, your daughter has been in rehab. She's currently in rehab, and she said she did really well for
a while. She did it for the first time she went in, but she said it wasn't really what she wanted. Like, at the time, she did it for us, and so she wasn't necessarily ready, and she definitely wasn't at rock bottom. So, but we don't really, it's hard to let a female go down rock bottom, because what they end up doing to get the drug is stuff you just don't want to think about.
Yeah.
So you try to help them think.
You see that on the movies, in the movies on TV.
Yeah, maybe they'll get it this time, or maybe they'll do it. Yeah. So I think maybe this time she really wants, but I have no idea. I really don't know. We might have to do this again.
You go into a new normal. When you have to reinvent yourself, and you have to come up with a new normal, because that, whatever it was supposed to be, as you were talking about, Randy was saying, and Marie, that you feel like that's what you want for your child, it's not working anymore. So you create a new normal. You have a new set of rules, new beginnings.
Absolutely. And I think part of the issue, and then we're going to bring in the doctor to maybe hear more of your story and have his perspective on it, is that with addiction, and again, I can relate with mental illness, because there's no clear timetable. I always call recovery like a game of chutes and ladders, if you remember playing that with your kids, you know, like you think you're there, and then right down the chute, and there you are all over again. And, you know, then
what a great
then
way to express it.
It's definitely like chutes and ladders. Yes. It's not like Candyland, where you get to the end. And so, I don't remember Candyland, but Diana.
Well, Marie, so just a question for you. So you discovered, you know, the needles, and all of those feelings that came up as parents. So once you knew that she had this addiction, what was it that you did next? Where did you go?
Well, then we researched places in the area to first put her into detox, assuming that she was agreeable to do it. But if she wasn't, I don't know. I guess I kept saying then we need to actually kick her out of the house, because I have another child and I didn't want her using in our house.
So like tough love.
Yeah, but my husband was not really game on for that one. So it's hard, because you want to help them, but you don't want to do too much and enable them.
So where, you know, so once you determined that you weren't going to kick her out of the house, I'm assuming.
Well, she agreed then she wanted to go in a place. So we found a place, and we put her in detox for 4 days. And then we found another place, and we put her in rehab for a month. These were both in Connecticut. And then the next step we had, after she got out of the rehab, then we had to put her in a sober living community, and we researched all over the country, different places. And it ended up that she went down to Florida. There's a big, big, big community of sober living and rehab down in Florida.
So how did you find as a family that you were able to support her? I mean, if she's, you know, in rehab or in sober living and down south, how were you able to support her as a family? Because I'm imagining that's huge.
Sometimes they need to do it themselves, don't they?
Well, we did support her up here, and we went to visit her, but down there we didn't. But we financially supported her in ways, and we talked to her on the phone as much as we could.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a question concerning finances. How do you cover the financial part of this whole rehab thing?
Well, part of it,
quickly, you can
part of it is covered by insurance, if you have insurance. If you don't, I think you're really going to be in trouble, because you really need to have insurance to cover a portion of it. Then you pay the copay you have to cover, but they can be pretty steep. And in the beginning, we did all that.
Is there a cap? Because I think there is a cap.
I really don't. Everybody's plan is different.
Yeah, yeah.
But what happened then, now she's just found her own places, and we said we can't even pay the copays anymore. So they I don't know what they do. They send her a bill, and she doesn't pay it, and they just, I don't know if they throw it out or what.
We could do a whole show on the finances.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, let's take a brief break, and we'll hear more, because I want to know if there are organizations and so on that are helping you. But it might be good if you get to speak to our doctors as well. So we're going to take a brief break, and then we'll come back with talking about addiction. Could it happen to you or your family? And we'll bring in Dr. Carlton Erickson. This is the Life Talk Show.
Got your taxes ready? Call Gabriel Tax and Accounting to schedule an appointment now at 203-367-7731. Gabriel Tax and Accounting, located in Bridgeport, has been serving the community for over 65 years. Get your taxes done at a better rate than any storefront. And remember, Gabriel Tax and Accounting is open year-round to serve all your accounting needs. Call Gabriel Tax and Accounting at 203-367-7731 for your peace of mind. Or visit GabrielTax.com. The Life Talk Show is sponsored by Dynamic Printing at 91 Main Street in Monroe, Connecticut. It's internet competitive prices with a storefront you can walk into. At Dynamic Printing, all your needs can be met. Everything from business cards to booklets and catalogs with that honest and friendly personal service they've been providing since 1994. Local or shipping anywhere. You can call them at 203-459-8762 or simply visit dynamicprinter.com. Dynamic Printing is flexible and they'll help you with the research and advice you need so that your printing needs match your business goals. They're flexible and they're right there in person. Again, it's internet competitive prices with a storefront you can walk into. Visit dynamicprinter.com for more information or call 203-459-8762. Dynamic Printing, a proud sponsor of the Life Talk Show. And we're back talking about addiction. Our guest is Marie, who's kind enough to share her family's story so far with her daughter, who is addicted to heroin and currently in rehab. I'm here with Nikki Tombolides, of course, and Diana Hall, the three co-hosts. And I'd like to bring in our guest today. It's Dr. Carlton Erickson. Dr. Erickson is a research scientist. He's been studying the effects of alcohol on the brain for over 45 years. He's the author of The Science of Addiction, From Neurobiology to Treatment. It's a lot of other kudos here, but let's just bring him in. Dr. Erickson, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here. Sounds like you have a fun show.
A fun show on a very serious topic, and we thank you so much for joining us today. So were you able to hear a bit of Marie's story with her family?
Yes, I was.
So we say hi to each other.
Hello.
So you are a resident expert right now, and I'd first like to ask you if you, from your research, how would you define addiction, and what have you discovered are some of the causes of it?
Well, you gals have had a wonderful discussion as to what it is and what it's not, and I think you're right on the money. The problem with the word addiction is that it's used by so many people, by the media and the general public, in a very what we call flippant way, you know, as scientists, because scientists think of addiction as much more narrow. You know, I just saw the other day a new addiction. It's wanting to look like Justin Bieber. Can you believe that? So these are popping up all the time. And, you know, I think about that, and there's no way that that comes even close to the addiction that scientists know with cocaine, heroin, you know, alcohol, nicotine. I mean, we've studied these for 30 years or so, and more recently neurobiologically, and what the causes are. So I would prefer to think of addiction as a narrower, more serious condition, which we know of as a brain disease. And so the scientists are now going along with the clinicians and the psychiatric association, American Psychiatric Association, that believes that we can diagnose who has addiction and who doesn't have addiction. And what we find is that you can't diagnose somebody by how much they use, how often they use it, and how long they use it. You actually have diagnostic criteria that have been published in their manual called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders.
And this is DSM-5 now, the newest one?
The newest one is 5. If we go back to edition 4, which is where it kind of started, people started to understand that you can diagnose individuals as having what's called chemical dependency, which is very close to addiction, as the general public should be knowing about it as they continue to learn about it. Chemical dependency is a brain disease, whereas the other category of drug users is called drug abusers. And these are people that you see just getting drunk on Friday night. You know, they may or may not be alcohol addicted, but a certain percentage of them will. And so we now, through the diagnostic techniques, can begin to put numbers as to how many people will become addicted or chemically dependent to heroin, to cocaine, to alcohol, and so forth. And the highest one, your audience might be interested to know, is nicotine. It's been estimated
higher than heroin?
Survey research that about
32%
of people who use nicotine products at any time during their lifetime will become dependent or addicted to nicotine. A lot of people say, well, that's really, really small, a lot lower than I expected, but there's a lot of other reasons why people have a hard time stopping other than just having a brain disease. And the lowest one is probably LSD at 4%. Marijuana comes in at 9%. Heroin comes in at 23%.
Mm. Wow, that's surprising.
Yeah. The science is starting to get rid of a lot of myths that people had, such as everybody who uses heroin is an addict. Well, we know that only 23% will develop dependence, chemical dependency, or addiction.
Wow, that's
during their
much
lifetime. The rest of the people you can call abusers, misusers, recreational users, bad people, criminals, or whatever you want to call them, but they're not addicted, and they never will be. So this is a big aha, I think, in this field, and we could talk about terminology for hours, but I know we don't have that much time.
Dr. Erickson, I'm just kind of blown away by the marijuana addiction as opposed to the heroin addiction. And do you think it's because heroin addiction, most users end up seeking out help or end up in rehab facilities where marijuana users are maybe not reported? Yeah, and of course, clearly what's going on, look at Colorado. I mean, is that where those numbers come in, do you believe, or do you really think that that is the difference? Because that's really surprising.
Well, these are preliminary numbers from the 1990s and what we call an epidemiological survey, and it was about 40,000 people. So, you know, they did take into account those types of factors that you're talking about. And it relates to whether you have it within yourself, within your brain, whether you have what it takes to become addicted. It's not necessarily the quality of the drug. It's how your brain relates to the drug, and as a neurobiologist, what I tend to think of is that it's how that particular drug connects to the neurobiology of your brain through what we call neurotransmitters. And so marijuana works through a different neurotransmitter than heroin, and it's the way that it works in relationship to the neurotransmission in the brain's reward pathway, which we call the mesolimbic dopamine system.
Right.
Are you saying that
how much a person will become addicted to it?
Are you saying that marijuana is not addictive as much as heroin, or the levels are different, it affects different sides of the brain, or?
Marijuana affects different receptors and neurotransmitter receptors
right.
of the brain. I'm not saying it's less addictive, because how do you measure addiction? You know, it's
right.
by the number of people who become addicted when they use it. Is it the severity? Is it how quickly you get it? So it's hard to say, is it more addicting than something else? But we know that fewer people become addicted to marijuana than heroin. Mm.
Right, and I'm hearing the science of it, absolutely. And from some of the research that I've seen says that this component of chemical addiction having to do with your neurobiology is genetic. Like, eventually, do you feel they might be able to pinpoint a gene for addiction where some people, and I think we're bearing in mind that there's physical/chemical addiction, and then there's psychological addiction, which can seem like addiction at much higher numbers than what science is talking about.
Well, the neurobiologists and pharmacologists have mainly been studying what you're calling physical addiction, but those are really old terms. They're 1950 terms. Scientists really don't talk about physical addiction and psychological addiction anymore. We talk about dependency, or now in the DSM-5, it's called substance use disorder. So the severe form of substance use disorder is probably closest to what the old diagnostic manual used to call chemical dependency. It's all physical, because it's all in the brain and with the neurotransmitters and so forth. The effects of the addiction or the effects of the dependence are psychological. I can't stop.
Okay.
I'm becoming a nasty person. I'm angry. You know, those and the psychological and the behavioral and the emotions, all of that is real, but that's not the cause of addiction. That's a result of addiction, where the drug connects to the certain parts of the body that I was talking to.
Which means that the treatment should reflect both the possibility of the substance abuse disorder and also the effects of it, which might need talk therapy and groups and things like that.
So what is the cause of addiction?
The cause of addiction, we talked about genetics a little bit. In the alcohol addiction field, where most of the genetics have been done, it indicates, the research indicates that up to 60% of all the causes of I'm going to call it alcohol dependence, are due to vulnerability through genetics, which means it's the thing that's most likely passed from generation to generation.
Right.
And then that other 40% is psychological factors, social factors, environmental factors, and things like that, which can help to trigger the disease. With the other drugs, we haven't done as much genetics research, but we certainly know that there's probably a heavy genetic component. And so, you know, person could have PTSD, for example, which would cause a disruption of the neurotransmitters in the brain, and that would make them more vulnerable to chemical dependency or addiction.
So why a lot of our veterans end up addicts, is that
right.
Correct?
How about mental illness?
You know, a lot of those veterans, I'm sorry to interrupt, but a lot of those veterans have never been diagnosed. We observe that they might be addicted by the way that they act and the way they use drugs, but keep in mind, the diagnosis is very important to be able to tell whether a person has the brain disease or does not, or is just using drugs as maybe self-medication, or maybe just because they want to get high and feel better.
And Nikki started to ask, thank you, that's very interesting. Nikki started to ask about mental illness, and as I've mentioned, I have a son with schizophrenia, and he's very, very proud to be clean and sober, and we're really lucky that he is. But sometimes I'm active in NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and it has really helped our family a lot. And we have brought in people who have said, doctors who have said that there is no such thing as addiction without a mental illness. It's always a dual diagnosis. And I'm wondering if you find that to be true, if only a certain percentage of people are chemically dependent or have this substance abuse disorder. Does it usually co-occur with something like PTSD or depression or bipolar or...
or anxiety or conduct disorder? Yeah, it certainly does. ADHD.
Yeah, ADHD.
They're starting to find out now that ADHD, for example, is a risk factor for alcohol dependence.
Wow.
Conduct disorder in young children is a risk factor for using alcohol when they get older, not necessarily becoming dependent. So we're just starting to figure that out through the comorbidity studies. But now I'm a NAMI member myself. It's a wonderful organization, and you have to know something about mental illness if you're going to study addiction. That being said, a lot of times chemical dependency pops out of nowhere where people don't seem to have any of the psychiatric illnesses. So we have to understand that the psychiatric illnesses may not be the cause of chemical dependency, but may be the result of chemical dependency. We know that depression, for example, secondary depression, is usually occurring after a person goes through treatment, and that's generally self-limiting. They get over it after a while, and then it'll pop up again later in life for whatever reason. And that all suggests simply what we call a dysregulation of the brain chemistry throughout the whole brain. And so the dysregulation will pop out as a mental illness, and other people it'll pop out as a drug problem. Other people it'll pop out as a compulsive disorder.
Dr. Erickson, I just have a quick question, because you mentioned ADHD, and Marie, you nodded your head and said your daughter has ADHD.
Yeah.
And is there a link between children being medicated for ADHD? Because I've heard that over and over again, sitting in many PPTs, parents' fears of, you know, of medicating, not over-medicating, medicating their child for ADHD, and later in life that child becoming dependent.
Right.
Yeah, I get asked that all the time by parents, should I medicate my child for ADHD? And my answer is always yes, because medicine operates on a benefit-to-risk ratio. The benefit of getting rid of the ADHD symptoms greatly overwhelms the likelihood, the small likelihood, that the kid will become dependent on the medication. In fact, it's even worse. In a properly diagnosed ADHD kid, if you don't give them stimulants or some other type of treatment. Sometimes they're using antidepressants and even talk therapy these days. But if you don't treat them, they will tend to self-medicate later in life with marijuana, cocaine, or alcohol mm-hmm. because they're feeling that they don't want to be ADHD, and so they're starting to use drugs now to calm that
down.
And indeed, we find that when drugs are used recreationally, like stimulants, heroin, I'm sorry, opioids, stimulants, and so forth, when they're used recreationally, the rate of dependence is much higher than when they're used therapeutically, across the board.
Wow. Dr. Erickson, we're coming on where we have to have a break, and we are going to bring in another expert as well. But I want to mention the name of your book one more time and also just ask you, if you had about 30 seconds to give some hope to Marie, I don't want to put you on the spot, so think about it while I name your book. Your book is The Science of Addiction, From Neurobiology to Treatment. I think if you Google it, you'll probably be brought to the Amazon page or to the website, which will be on our blog post. But it's utexas.edu/research/... didn't get the rest of it. But The Science of Addiction... Go ahead. After research, it's /
ASREC, Addiction Science Research and Education Science.
Thank you so much.
It will be on our website.
It'll be on our website. So you know, just we have about a minute going up to break. Is there anything you could say to Marie to give her some hope here?
Maybe medication works or anything?
First thing I'd like to say is, Marie, this is a lifetime disease that didn't occur in 28 days, and so... we can't expect that 28 days or 30 days of treatment is going to cure a person, and sometimes it takes multiple treatments. I know you don't want to hear that, but
she knows it all.
I know some people who have had to go through 5 or 6 treatments to get better. Heroin is a nasty drug, but like any other disease, this disease comes in mild, moderate, and severe forms, and let's hope that your daughter has a mild form, which would, by definition, be easier to treat, because sometimes people do go through one treatment or just 12 steps, and they're fine for the rest of their lives, and they probably have a mild form. Diagnosis, extremely important. Don't listen to people who say this is not a disease. The neurobiological and genetic research clearly shows that people who have what it takes will get this disease, and that's why we need treatment. Mm-hmm. And make sure you find a good treatment center. And I'm going to put a plug in here because we don't know as much about addiction and drugs as we do about AIDS, cancer, and heart disease. We need everybody to be able to accept and push Congress, accept when they suggest more money for the National Institutes of Health, and really maybe tell Congress that we should have more money for the addiction treatment, knowledge of its causes, how to prevent it, and so forth. Let's get some more money in so that scientists can do the job and answer all the questions we need answered.
And to that I say amen.
Thank you, Dr.
Carl Erickson, thank you so much for your time, and we hope you'll stay with us for a bit. We are bringing in next Dr. Marina Picciotto. This is the Life Talk Show.
Got your taxes ready? Call Gabriel Tax and Accounting to schedule an appointment now at 203-367-7731. Gabriel Tax and Accounting, located in Bridgeport, has been serving the community for over 65 years. Get your taxes done at a better rate than any storefront. And remember, Gabriel Tax and Accounting is open year-round to serve all your accounting needs. Call Gabriel Tax and Accounting at 203-367-7731 for your peace of mind. Or visit GabrielTax.com. The Life Talk Show is sponsored by Dynamic Printing at 91 Main Street in Monroe, Connecticut. It's internet competitive prices with a storefront you can walk into. At Dynamic Printing, all your needs can be met. Everything from business cards to booklets and catalogs with that honest and friendly personal service they've been providing since 1994. Local or shipping anywhere. You can call them at 203-459-8762 or simply visit dynamicprinter.com. Dynamic Printing is flexible and they'll help you with the research and advice you need so that your printing needs match your business goals. They're flexible and they're right there in person. Again, it's internet competitive prices with a storefront you can walk into. Visit dynamicprinter.com for more information or call 203-459-8762. Dynamic Printing, a proud sponsor of the Life Talk Show.
And today's topic on the Life Talk Show, we're talking about addiction. Can it happen to you or to someone in your family, and what can be done about it? We have with us today Marie, whose daughter is currently in rehab and about to be released. We've just spoken with Dr. Carlton Erickson, author of The Science of Addiction, From Neurobiology to Treatment. And now we welcome another expert, and this is Dr. Marina Picciotto from Yale, professor of neurobiology and pharmacology. And let me see if I have this straight. Marina's research focuses on the role of nicotinic acetylcholine receptors in behaviors. Is that correct? Dr. Picciotto.
That's right. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Welcome, Dr. Picciotto.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Life Talk Show. We've been talking about addiction, and Dr. Erickson just chimed in with the percentages of chemical dependency as an actual substance abuse disorder. And so we were wondering if you could bring your expertise, and we're here with Marie as well, whose daughter is addicted to heroin and is currently finishing her fifth try at rehab, did you say?
Yes.
Okay, and the daughter is 22. So we welcome you to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So our opening question is, why would you, in your opinion, people with psychiatric illnesses, why are they more susceptible to addiction and have more difficulty quitting? Like, what have you found in your research?
Well, that's a great question, and we study that specifically with respect to smoking and depression, or smoking and schizophrenia. But certainly there's a much higher degree of drug use in general among people with psychiatric disorders, and there are a lot of theories about this. One is simply that people who have substance abuse disorders are trying to treat some aspect, self-medicate some aspect of psychiatric illness with a drug. So imagine that you are very depressed. Some of the drugs that you start taking at first give you a euphoria, a feeling of feeling good. And then over time, the addictive properties of those drugs keep you taking them, but the aspect of self-medication may have been what started you taking that drug in the first place. In my own work, we study how people who smoke may, in fact, treat aspects of their own attentional dysfunction. We know that people with schizophrenia, of course, have many very serious aspects of problems, such as delusions and hallucinations. But one of the things that makes people with schizophrenia have such a hard time holding down a job or staying in the community is their inability to focus, to pay attention, to avoid distractions. And one of the things that the nicotine in tobacco can do is that it can work on circuits in the brain that are normally used for your ability to pay attention when you're doing a difficult task and screen out irrelevant stimuli. And it's thought that perhaps people with schizophrenia smoke at such a high rate, maybe up to 90% of people with schizophrenia when the last studies that I know of were done, maybe using the nicotine and tobacco to help them screen out the distractions in their lives.
Yes, this is Randy. I do have a son with schizophrenia, and one of the most powerful things I learned was that nicotine affects the gating receptors. That's how it was explained to me. And I'm an avid anti-smoker, and there would come a point, especially when my son wasn't reacting that well to his medication, that I would go, please go smoke a cigarette and come back, because he really was more able to focus after that cigarette. And
actually, they encouraged that. From NAMI, that I took a class, that they said smoking for schizophrenia, it helps them.
Yeah, well, they don't know if they encourage it, but
it,
at least they encourage that we understand.
To understand it and that it helps them.
Mm-hmm. And what, is there anything in your research having to do with heroin addiction and just when do people start getting addicted and why do people relapse into addiction after many years clean and sober?
That's so important. We know that there are differences in susceptibility to addiction, even to heroin. When I was a kid, I thought, oh, my goodness, if you try heroin once, that's it, you're addicted. And for some individuals, that may be the case. And particularly, there are genetic differences that make some people more likely to get addicted quickly versus other people who may be somewhat protected. And certainly, there are environmental factors, so early life stresses, poverty, current life stresses are all, they all act on, of course, your environment, but they're also changing how your brain reacts to those drugs of abuse, and they can also, those experiences can make you more likely to get addicted in the first place. But I think one of the questions that you asked is, how can people stay clean for years, maybe decades, and all of a sudden relapse? And there's a lot of research on this. One of the things that I think we should all be very aware of is that what drugs of abuse are very good at is linking the cues in your environment to your behavior. So, for example, imagine that there's a particular bar that you always go into, and that's where you have a drink. And if you're an alcoholic, you may stay clean for years and years, and then you walk into that bar because someone asks you to meet them there, and all of a sudden the urge to drink is unbelievably irresistible, and that person may relapse to alcoholism, even if they've been clean for a long time.
So bring back memories, Dr. Picciotto. This is Nikki. Yeah. It will bring back the memories of...
So
right.
It's just
your drinking.
It's a trigger.
A trigger?
You and I might think about it as remembering, but what the brain does is it really links what you perceive to an immediate behavior. It's almost as if the automatic behaviors, the learning of just the actions you take to take up a glass and to drink, or to take the needle and inject heroin, or to open the pack and smoke a cigarette, becomes driven by the things that you see and perceive in your environment. And that's called cue-induced craving. We can model that in basic science studies, but it's very clear that for some people, the best way to stay clean is really to stay away from those cues as much as possible. Change environments. Make sure that you're not exposed to the things that were very closely associated with the drug. Obviously, that's not always possible.
I remember, Dr. Picciotto, when I was smoking, people would say, because I went through smoke stoppers and I went through hypnosis, and a lot of people said to me the best way to quit is to avoid having coffee, avoid staying on the phone long, get out of those habits, hang around the friends that smoke. You know, you just have to change your habits.
And your
As Randy said, get the trigger out.
Absolutely. And that's true, especially for smoking, of course, because we can smoke in so many places, so a lot of things become associated with smoking. But for drugs that you take, may take in a very specific place or with very specific people, hopefully it will be a little bit more possible to change the environment and not get exposed to those cues, those triggers.
Just following along, Diana has a question, but before we leave this topic, so, because we do have a mom here who's got a 22-year-old daughter who she's scared of what's going to happen when her daughter gets out of rehab, and I know I'm sure, Marie, you know there are no guarantees that we're just looking for some ideas. So if we can be negatively influenced by a cue such as the bar we used to drink at, is there such a thing as building positive cues? For instance, is that part of what makes NA and AA positive, because you see people every day who are also trying to remain clean and sober, and that can... You know, there's neuroplasticity of the brain. Can that rewire parts of your brain that wants to stay sober by having new cues for sobriety and cleanliness that you constantly expose yourself to?
Absolutely, and what a great way to put that, to learn new triggers and to have those triggers be positive, so that you may now have the impulse to reach for the phone and call your sober companion, or you may have the impulse to... if you have a craving for a drug, to substitute it with a craving for something healthy, whether it's exercise or something that is positive and pleasurable in your life, to relearn those triggers is a fantastic way. It's obviously an extremely difficult thing to do, but the more that you can replace negative behaviors and triggers with positive ones, the more successful you might be.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Dr. Picciotto, so that was a lot of terrific information for people, families of addicts or addicts that may be listening in. But just to go a different route, being a mom of teenagers, and Marie, you have another child, and Randy, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there thinking, Okay, what can I do to avoid addiction or help my children to avoid addiction? And is it possible to do that, to train the way you think? Or, I don't know, maybe you can give us some insight into that.
Well, that's a good question, and I think if we as scientists had the answer, it would be a lot easier to protect the kids in our around us. I think that one of the things that we know just from studies of addiction is that there are protective things in the environment. One of those protective things is sports and exercise. So kids who are involved in serious sports and who are active are less likely to become addicted, to move to addiction. And there are many reasons for that. One is, of course, that you may love that so much that you know that addiction, or whether it's heroin or smoking, may disrupt your ability to do something you love. But the other is that it's very good for your brain. Exercise makes new connections. Exercise is one of the best antidepressants, behavioral antidepressants that we know. It causes positive changes in the brain that allow you to be resistant to stress in your environment. So that's one thing we can certainly do to help our kids. The other things that we can do is to make sure that they have people around them, family around them that they can talk to and that they have positive relationships with. There's good evidence that kids who are able to spend positive time with their families and form strong relationships with them are somewhat protected. Those kinds of behavioral positive things in the environment are a lot like those rebuilding of circuits that we were just talking about in order to protect people from relapsing to addiction. They're also protective from moving toward addiction.
Thank you so much. Just so you know, we have about 5 minutes left in the show.
Marie has a quick question.
Marie, the mom, would like to ask you a question.
Are teenagers at a higher risk for addiction?
Yes, they are. And we know that the teenage brain is a time, the brain is just so changeable. There are many things happening. We know that toddlers, for example, are just making all of the connections in their brains between how they interact with the world, and that happens again in adolescence. And particularly as you get the surge of hormones as you become a teenager, you're rewiring all of the, especially all of the higher order parts of the brain that are important for making decisions. As adults, we are very lucky. We've evolved this part of our cortex, the prefrontal cortex, which is really there to say, I know you feel like doing something, but it's not going to be good for you in the long run. Stop. And it's exactly this part of the brain that's maturing during adolescence. So there's a lot of more difficulty with impulse control. There's a lot more difficulty with avoiding sensation seeking, with avoiding new experience. Mm-hmm. And then once you do have those experiences with substances, with whether it's legal substances that are not legal for teenagers, such as drinking and smoking, or illegal drugs like heroin and cocaine, they are more able to remap the brain in adolescence than they are in adulthood. So, yes, teenagers are really at higher risk than adults for developing, for getting addicted, and for, in fact, trying drugs and abuse as well.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, and I just like Dr. Erickson, are you still on the line? Can you still speak?
I am, yes.
Cool. Okay, so I would like to, we usually just leave about a minute at the end of the show for last-minute tips, but I'd like to spend a little more time on that. And so for both of our doctors, I think the question I'd like to discuss for a second, and then we'll finish out with just last-minute tips from everybody. Let's talk about support systems for people who are trying to recover. Mm-hmm. I know I heard sometimes that it's better if the family stays away, that they need to be proud of themselves, and they don't want their parents to be proud of them. I mean, are parents part of the trigger? That, you know, how much do we leave them alone to figure it out? What have you found is the best support system, and what can parents do or loved ones do to support somebody who is in recovery?
Marie, in our case here.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marie,
right now. Yeah, and everybody listening.
And any thoughts on that? I know you're more into the science of it, but I know this is your field. So I'll ask Dr. Picciotto first. Any thoughts on that?
I think it may be very particular to each individual. I do think that there's a certain degree to which we cannot take responsibility for someone else. In the end, it has to be a decision and an ownership that's taken by the person who is addicted. And there may be families where interacting with the family is a trigger and it is a stress. And there may be others where the family can intervene successfully. So I think that it will be on a case-by-case basis.
Okay. Dr. Erickson, anything you would add to that?
Just two quick things. And the 12-step programs now are known by some scientists, especially those who work on them, as evidence-based programs. And so they have been studied quite a bit. And what we know is that in 12-step programs, the continuing relationship with the sponsor, making sure the person goes to 12-step programs, can be very supportive. Secondly, really quickly, there's a new recovery movement going on across the nations, Faces and Voices of Recovery. And there are literally Faces and Voices of Recovery organizations in every state and every major city. And they band together to support each other and to support those people who need the help.
So those are. And Marie, have you found any organizations helpful to you in your journey to, you know, it's that parenting is that balance always of stepping in and letting go. And when you add, in my case, mental illness, and in your case, addiction, when you add addiction to the picture of that very delicate area between teens and early 20s when our children are struggling, how much do I need my parents? I mean, my children have both come around to be happy to need me, but it was a long journey.
Right.
So, you know, so when we're struggling with that tightrope, really, have you found any support for yourself that has helped you?
Well, I went to Families Anonymous, which was good. I met a lot of people that are in the same boat, and that really encouraged me, especially if somebody's child
you know that you're
is
not
in
alone.
A good place, and I could see that it does happen. It gives me a little bit of hope. And I also went to Al-Anon and went to some of those meetings and listened. And you get people, they give you their phone number, you can call them and talk to them, and they understand what I'm going through, so I value what they have to say.
All right, excellent. Thank you. So in the actually like a minute and a half we have remaining, Dr. Erickson and Dr. Picciotto, I'll let you go last so you can think for a second. But if you had like a 15-second tip or the message that you would most want us to close the show with regarding addiction, what would it be? So, Diana, I'll start with you.
Okay, as a mom of teenagers, raising children to remain addiction-free, parents must lead by example. Forgo the do as I say, not as I do, how many times have we said that, attitude. Prevent addiction from developing in children by practicing moderation in your own life.
Okay, Nikki?
I just have to say what my dad always said, and Greek people always say that. Tell me who's your friend, I tell you who you are. And my dad always gave me the example of Rumi, one of my dad's favorite stories, the man and the bear. The man saved the bear from a snake, and the bear decided to be his faithful friend. One day, while the man was asleep, the bird decided to crush the flies with a large stone so that don't disturb his friend. Problem, the man was crushed, and the flies escaped. The moral of the story, do not make friends with fools. So
try
be
telling
careful.
Your teenager
the
that.
The teenager is very important, and to all of us, make sure, tell me who's your friend. Be careful who you make friends with.
Yeah, it definitely is. Mm-hmm. But as we were talking about the frontal cortex, the logic centers of our brain, very often parents have to lend their frontal cortex to their children, and the children don't always want to borrow it.
And your tip, Randy?
So my tip would be sometimes, you know, in your own home, you can set limits that at least are true in your own home, which will help. But to me, it boils down to the serenity prayer,
right.
You know, letting go, changing what you can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Marie, would you like to say anything?
Oh, I think you just have to really open your eyes if you're a parent and look for signs and just don't be in denial because there are a lot of kids out there that are using.
Yeah, don't say not my kid.
Right.
And yeah,
it's
always a shock.
Anyone.
Dr. Erickson?
I would like to say that your listeners should re-listen to this show. I think the quality of the information on this show is among the best that I've ever been involved in, and it's because it comes all the way from the people who are feeling the pain of the disease to the people who are doing the leading-edge research that are going to help a lot more people in the future. So listen to this show again.
Great. And thank you so much. And we will make the link available to anybody that you would like to share it with. Thank you so much. And Dr. Picciotto, your last tip?
Well, I'd like to end with saying that we should remember that addiction is not a failure of character. It's not evil thing that someone does to society. It's a disease. It's a brain illness. It's a consequence of a drug hijacking how the brain works, and that we should treat the disease and not stigmatize the addict.
And not stigmatize, yeah.
That is fabulous. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being on the show. Dr. Erickson, thank you so much for your time. And Marie,
thank you. You've been listening to The Life Talk Show. You've been listening to The Life Talk Show on WDJZ-AM. If you have an idea for a future topic, would like to be a guest or a sponsor of our show, or just tell us what you think, please email us at info@thelifetalkshow.com. Our Twitter handle is @LifeTalkShow, and our Facebook page is The Life Talk Show. Sharing ideas for meaning, joy, and success. The Life Talk Show with Randy, Diana, and Nikki on WDJZ AM. Every Saturday at 4, The Life Talk Show. Join us.